In 2001, there was a lot of buzz about a new invention that was going to come out that was going to change the world as we know it. This was backed by a lot of money, had some really smart and creative people, and had one particular inventor that a lot of people expected a lot from. He said that this thing that he was inventing was going to transform transportation as we know it. It was going to be to the car what the car was to the horse and buggy. They let very little information about this invention out. They just called it or Ginger. And so there was just all this secrecy around it. And so that caused people to start to wonder, what is this thing going to be? Is it going to be a hydrogen-powered hoverboard? Is it going to be a magnetic anti-gravity device? What is this thing going to do? Fast forward 15 years later, our Segway parking space has become a little bit overgrown out there. This morning, none of you rode a Segway to worship. And even if it weren't raining outside, you would not have ridden a Segway to worship. It was promoted in such a way that it was going to change the world. And as it turned out, it's just a super fun Groupon that we've bought, but nothing else. It has had no impact on our lives, except maybe in the malls or in the airports. What advertising does is it builds your expectations for something. And there is kind of a tendency to overpromise. We do this to each other all of the time. Someone tells you, I saw this movie. It was absolutely amazing. You have to see it. You get all excited. You go, you rent the movie, you watch it, and you say, I didn't really get it. You look up a book online. You read the reviews for it. The reviews say, this is amazing. This book will change your life. You read the book, and your life is no different than before you read it. Your friend tells you, I tried this diet. It was amazing. I lost 10 pounds and I never gained it back. You try the diet. It doesn't work for you. People build our expectations of things all the time. Those expectations aren't always met. Sometimes a person will mention a friend that they know. You should meet my friend Michael. He is the funniest guy that I know. So that when you meet Michael, you have this expectation that he is going to tell you a joke, that he's going to make you laugh. Someone says, you should meet my friend Linda. She is the most compassionate person you will ever meet. When you go to meet Linda, you are going to expect her to care about what's going on in your life. You should meet my friend Sheldon. He's the smartest person I have ever met in my life. When you meet Sheldon, you're going to expect him to be smart. People set up our expectations for when we go to meet a person. I like introducing speakers because I feel like so often that is done really poorly. Often someone will stand up to introduce a speaker and they will read off a biography of them. It may list some really incredible accomplishments, but as you are watching them do this, you're hearing about these accomplishments, but they're not connecting with you because you're realizing this person doesn't really know the person that they are introducing. So I think that introductions are so important. They should be done so well. One of the best introductions we are ever going to find is the introduction that John the Baptist gives in Mark Chapter 1. This introduction contains just enough detail and then a bunch of secrecy that makes you wonder what and who is he talking about. Mark chapter 1, verse 7, and he, who is John the Baptist, preached, saying, after me comes he who is mightier than I, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. I have baptized you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit. He says that someone is coming who is mighty, someone who is strong, Someone who is so incredibly mighty that John the Baptist himself is not worthy to perform a lowly act of service for him, the act of untying his sandal. He doesn't give any more detail than that. He simply says, someone is coming who is so great that I couldn't even be his servant. John the Baptist himself is a pretty sensational, larger-than-life kind of guy. We read that he wears a coat made of camel's hair. He's got a huge leather belt around his waist and a big Texas belt buckle on that. I don't think that's true, but he's known by what he wears, by his diet of locust dripped with honey. He gives us these details as a way of saying, here is this guy that you are going to pay attention to when he talks. This guy is like unlike anyone else you've ever met. He is like only one other person, and that is Elijah. In the Old Testament, Elijah was known for wearing his camel hair jackets, for his leather belts, and for his very odd diet. So here is this guy named John. He's introduced by Scripture as the sort of reincarnation of Elijah. And he is drawing people to himself at the River Jordan. We read that Judea and Jerusalem were coming out to him. That's kind of like saying Boston and Beacon Hill were coming out to see this guy. These are the cultural influencers, the elites of society. Here's this guy who seems to be making some difference in the world. He is preparing people for something incredible. And then he says, there's someone coming after me who is so much greater you could not even imagine. Your expectations for this guy are really high. You've got all kinds of questions. Is this guy going to be 10 feet tall? Is he going to have superpowers? Is he going to hover? Is he going to look like he's hooked up to a car battery because he's glowing so brightly? What kind of sandals does he wear that they need to be untied? What was the technology back then? You start to wonder, what is this guy going to be? Haddon Robinson, in his book on preaching, gives some advice about introductions. He says, don't overpromise in your introductions, because that would be like shooting off a cannon and then shooting out a pea. So there's this huge cannon explosion, and out of the cannon rolls a little green legume. That would be pretty uneventful. That would be pretty disappointing. And that's kind of what appears to happen after John's amazing introduction of Jesus. In verse 9, we read, in those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Here's this guy. The only way he stands out, perhaps, is that he comes from a different part of the country. Rather than being one of the cultural elites, he comes from kind of the back country. This would be like saying, and a guy came from Essex, or a guy came from Shrewsbury, or a guy came from Shirley, or, you know, some place that's kind of out of the mainstream, out of where the people that are high society live. This guy comes, and just like everyone else, steps into the murky waters of the Jordan, and he is baptized. He gets up out of the water, and skipping a few verses, we read in verse 12 that the Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness. And he was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild animals, and the angels were ministering to him. So if you were there watching this whole thing, what you would see and what you would hear would be just a backcountry guy coming into the Jordan, getting baptized, and then just walking off the scene, going out into the wilderness. What is happening is that Jesus is boldly going where every single Jew has boldly gone before. What he is doing is he is reenacting the drama of Israel, the story of his people. One of the crucial stories in the Old Testament is the story of the Exodus, where the people are delivered out of Egypt. They go through the waters of the Red Sea, and then they enter into the wilderness for 40 years. Jesus goes through the water of the Jordan, and he enters into the wilderness for 40 days. What Mark is trying to say is that Jesus is just like every other Jewish person who has lived before him. He is going through the same things that they have experienced. He is going out into the wilderness, that place where people are tested by God. He is doing what all of you have done in the past. Mark is making the point that Jesus relates to his people. I don't know if about a month ago you saw a picture show up on the internet. I'm going to try to show it to you. This person here, do you recognize him? You seen this picture? This is a picture that was put together by some British anthropologists and some Israeli archaeologists who applied the science of forensic anthropology to come up with what they think might be the most likely representation of what Jesus looked like. So I don't totally understand all of the science behind it, but apparently they took some skulls from that time, reconstructed them, thought about the diet, thought about other drawings of people that they had during that time. And this is what they believe is the most accurate or the best estimation of what Jesus may have looked like. It's kind of surprising, isn't it? It kind of takes you back. He usually, when we see Jesus depicted, he has long hair. It is lightly colored. It's not curly like that. He generally has lighter eyes. He, in paintings, interestingly, is often taller than anyone else in the painting. He's the kind of person, he's often depicted as the kind of person that we would be, that our eyes would be attracted to, that we would notice, that would stand out in the crowd. But the point that is being made here is that Jesus didn't stand out from anyone else. He looked exactly like them. He identified with them in every way, almost. There's one significant difference about Jesus than all of the other Jewish people that had ever lived and every single human had ever lived. While they were all going into the Jordan to be baptized for the forgiveness of their sins, instead we read that when Jesus was baptized, in verse 10, when he came up out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." When Jesus is baptized, just like the water was parted for the Israelites, this time the heavens are parted, they are torn open, and Jesus hears a voice, not of the forgiveness of sins, but of the assurance of the Father's love. Jesus hears a voice from heaven, God himself saying, "You are my beloved Son. With you, I am well pleased." Jesus hears about his Father's incredible love for him, a love that Jesus had known since the beginning of time. Before anything else existed, Jesus knew about the Father's love as a member of the Trinity. And now, as the incarnated human Jesus, he receives confirmation once again that he is the beloved Son of God. This is the lens by which Mark intends that we read the Gospel of Mark, that Jesus is the Son of God. It is in the very first verse of the Gospel. In verse 1, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We are intended to see that everything Jesus does is done as the Son of God. Every single word that Jesus speaks are the words of the beloved Son of God. And so what Jesus is doing is he is showing us what the beloved Son of God would do. There is one other allusion here to the history of Israel and to the Old Testament. This one goes beyond the Exodus. It goes all the way to the very beginning of the Bible. In the first chapter of Genesis, we read that there was darkness and void over the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. That word hovering, in some translations, uses the word, same word here that is used for a dove. And so as Jesus is coming out and the Spirit is coming down on him like a dove, what Jesus is doing is actually instituting a new creation. He is leading the way to a brand new way of being, a brand new creation. Just like when God's Spirit created order out of this world, this new man emerges, and just like Adam, Jesus has a relationship with the animals. We read that out in the desert, Jesus was with the wild animals. Adam, he named the wild animals. And just like Adam, Jesus has an encounter with Satan. We know how that turned out for Adam. We know the results every single day of Adam and Eve's failure to resist the temptation that Satan set before them. All of the pain that we experience in our own lives, all of the things that we see every day in the news, all of the violence that our world is covered in is a result of Adam and Eve's failure to resist the temptation of Satan. And now we have this new man emerging out of the waters with the Spirit on him, going out to face temptation. But Mark doesn't tell us how he does. Mark doesn't give us any of the details of Jesus' encounter with Satan in the wilderness. What he intends for us is to see that throughout the rest of the book are the results of that encounter there in the wilderness. Jesus emerges from the wilderness after 40 days. He calls disciples to him, and then he begins to heal people, and he begins to cast out demons. He begins to do things that people had never seen before. And in Mark chapter 3, Jesus is accused of casting out demons by using the power of Satan. Jesus says to them, "That is absolutely ridiculous. A house divided against itself cannot stand." Then Jesus says that you don't go into a strong man's house and just start taking his stuff. You don't walk out with his widescreen TV and his jewelry from his dresser. You simply cannot do that because the strong man is in the house. What you've got to do, you've got to go in the house, you've got to bind the strong man. Then once that strong man is bound, you can plunder the house. You can take whatever you want. What Jesus is saying is that he has gone into the strong man's house. He has entered into Satan's territory, and he has bound Satan by overcoming him in the wilderness. And now that Satan is bound, now that his power has been taken away, Jesus is going around healing and casting out demons, plundering Satan's house, taking all of these people to himself. Jesus did what none of us could do. Where all of us failed in our temptation, where all of us gave in to Satan, Jesus Christ alone, the new creation, he overcame him in the wilderness. And now, as the Son of God who has overcome Satan, Jesus opens the way to a brand new creation. John promised that Jesus would not baptize with water, but he would baptize with the Holy Spirit. What he's saying is that the same power that Jesus has to overcome evil and to live the new creation will be given to everyone who follows Jesus. Just like him, through that same power, we will be able to live in a way that no one has ever lived before. There is no way that you could overpromise a new creation. Jesus Christ is doing something that no one has ever done before. He is showing a way to live and making it possible for those to follow that follow him to live in the exact same way. Jesus, the Son of God, is opening the way to a brand new creation. When Mark tells us that this voice came out of heaven, he uses the verb that says that the heavens were torn open in verse 10. That verb, torn, is different than just saying that the heavens were opened up. It's saying that the heavens were ripped apart in such a way that they could never be put back together in the same way again. The next time that Mark uses that verb is at the end of his gospel. When Jesus dies on the cross, we read that the curtain in the temple is torn in two, taking away that barrier between human beings and God, never to be put back together again. Jesus is opening up a whole new way of life. The segue, I know, did not change the way that we live. But I do remember about 10 years before the segue was introduced, I was about 10 years old. I was watching on the news people climbing up on a wall and people taking these sledgehammers and smashing the wall and celebrating like I had never seen people celebrate before. And I wasn't really old enough to understand what was happening. I understood that this was in Germany, that it was called the Berlin Wall, that people were really excited about taking that wall down, about tearing down the wall. I didn't realize that this was really history in the making, that I was actually seeing something absolutely phenomenal, that a country had been divided, that a continent had been divided, a city was divided, families were divided, and tearing down that wall created a new reality. That in this new reality, things would never go back to the way that we were. Jesus does no less and so much more than that. By coming to this earth, the heavens have been torn open, and we have an opportunity for a brand new relationship with God. Jesus Christ is leading the way into this new creation. It is making it possible for us to live in a way that no one has ever lived before. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He calls us to follow him into this new creation.